From New York Public Radio, this is On the Media. On the Media is produced by WNYC and heard across America on NPR stations. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Support your local public radio station. Visit onthemedia.org to find where On the Media is playing near you. And please help support this free service by becoming a member of WNYC at WNYC.org. WNYC On Demand is supported by Open from American Express, presenting the interactive webcast event, Making a Name for Yourself. Kate and Andy Spade and Bobby Brown discuss their leap from business to brand, created by Open from American Express. Registration at openforumonline.com.
From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. It was the fifth anniversary of 9/11, and to commemorate the infamy, the president addressed the nation. For 17 minutes, he spoke of tragedy, grief, solidarity, and vigilance. Oh, and Iraq. He also brought up Iraq.
Whatever mistakes have been made in Iraq, the worst mistake would be to think that if we pulled out, the terrorists would leave us alone. They will not leave us alone. They will follow us. The safety of America depends on the outcome of the battle in the streets of Baghdad.
It was a brief but remarkable tangent, rich with contradictions. For one thing, only minutes earlier, the president had claimed, quote, the world is safer because Saddam Hussein is no longer in power, and terrorists at our heels is a counterintuitive image of safety. Secondly, passive voice or no, the words mistakes have been made constituted a rare moment of self-criticism from the Bush administration about the war. One day before, after all, Vice President Cheney had declared,
it was the right thing to do, and if we had it to do over again, we'd do exactly the same thing.
For many, though, the most discordant note was the juxtaposition of the content with the occasion. A day of national mourning and reflection injected, to use the Dallas Morning News' term, with a sales pitch for staying the course in Iraq. The White House had framed the speech as nonpartisan, but congressional Democrats, after hearing the echoes of Republican talking points hammered relentlessly for the past 2 weeks, said no chance. Expropriating the sacred day to justify the country's most contentious policy issue, they said, was shamelessly political. Tuesday in the White House briefing room, Presidential Press Secretary Tony Snow was under siege by reporters, among them CBS's Jim Axelrod.
The president's speech last night political?
No.
How can you say that?
Because on...
Tony, you were here Friday.
What was the political statement? Well, tell me what the political sentence was.
Exactly,
give me the
it was.
Sentence.
It was a crystallized greatest hits of the eight-day period in which he made four speeches where he laid out his philosophical underpinnings about the war on terror heading into the election. And it was in direct contrast to what you came in here and told us Friday.
No, it's not in direct contrast.
Yes, it was. You said Friday that there would be no drawing of lines, distinctions between Democrats and Republicans.
And there wasn't.
It would focus on unity.
There wasn't.
Well, of course there was, implicitly, because the stay the course issue breaks down unmistakably along party lines. Maybe, as Snow insisted, President Bush would have been accused of sanitizing history had he glossed over Iraq, but let's just say injecting war policy into remembrance was just plain vulgar. The question is, what is the press's role when a politician is caught red-handed being political?
Now, it would be nice if every primetime presidential speech were the Gettysburg Address and every solemn moment accorded the comity it is due. But exploiting the public's emotions, prejudices, confusion, and fear is not only not unprecedented, it's more or less standard procedure. And it's scarcely a Republican monopoly. Though the Democrats squealed that a moment of national unity had been sullied, the next day the New York Times was not wrong to notice that the Democratic leadership had their fingers poised on the send button when the political opportunity knocked, which is what provoked the affair's true outrage, courtesy of Republican Congressman John Boehner.
Sometimes based on the votes that get cast, you wonder whether they're more interested in the rights of the terrorists than in protecting the American people.
Ah, from the House Majority Leader, an accusation of treason, a partisan obscenity which once upon a time might have stopped the presses. On this day, though, the calumny seemed merely to stop the momentum of the story, transforming an issue of presidential propriety into just another congressional catfight. The next day, the major papers gave the story short shrift, consigning the coverage inside, and one network news broadcast, the CBS Evening News with Katie Couric, gave it no shrift at all. So what happened between the White House briefing room and the final editorial decisions? Maybe only that an era of savage right-wing rhetoric and a day of trigger-finger Democratic protest had defined obscenity down.
Seen through a media lens, that is to say our lens, it would seem that most of the administration's public relations resources over the past 5 years have been directed toward selling a war. And over the years, we've heard from many people who have watched how the White House made that sale through its official statements, well-timed leaks, and scarifying rhetoric. Now that tangled tale has been served up in stunning detail in the book Hubris, The Inside Story of Spin, Scandal, and the Selling of the Iraq War by David Korn, Washington editor of The Nation, and Newsweek's Michael Isikoff. So on the occasion of that book and the administration's renewed campaign to resell the war, David Korn joins us now to explain how it was done and is still being done. David, welcome to OTM.
Good to be with you.
So, the book opens with a quote from an Austrian journalist and press critic who lived at the turn of the century, and he wrote, "How is the world ruled, and how do wars start? Diplomats tell lies to journalists and then believe what they read."
Well, I think that Austrian press critic, Karl Kraus, got it pretty close to the mark. There is a feedback loop so that claims the White House made, sometimes claims that parts of the government didn't even believe, would go through the media, and then the White House would point to that to prove their case.
So let's try and track that process through a case study. And we thought we could do it by following the tale of the tubes.
The tubes were high-strength aluminum tubes that one CIA analyst believed were going to be used for nuclear centrifuges to enrich uranium for nuclear bombs in Iraq. They had evidence that Iraq had purchased tens of thousands of these. Now, the problem was the top scientists at the Department of Energy looked at the tubes and said, no, they wouldn't work in these centrifuges. They're not evidence of a nuclear weapons program. And this was fought within the intelligence community behind the scenes for over a year. And yet the one CIA analyst who hung onto this point kept winning interagency tussles about this. And come September 2002, Dick Cheney went to meet the press and he says, we have evidence of a nuclear weapons program going on in Saddam Hussein's Iraq. And he points to a front page story out that day on the New York Times.
And so how did that story get there?
Well, that story was written by Judy Miller and Michael Gordon. And a lot of people blame Judy Miller, whose reporting on WMDs has come under a strong attack, mostly justifiably. But actually, it was Michael Gordon, the well-known, respected defense correspondent for the New York Times, who heard that there was intelligence, that there were tubes being bought that had been intercepted even, that were evidence of a nuclear weapons program.
Judy Miller has since said on this show and elsewhere that she relied on sources that she believed were reliable. I mean, where did the press fall down on due diligence?
To be fair to Michael Gordon and to Judy Miller, you know, they are reporting what their sources are telling them. But it's a follow-up where they probably fell down more so than on the original piece. But what happened was after they reported that piece, after Dick Cheney made it, Exhibit A, David Albright, a former weapons inspector who runs a small think tank in Washington, who was privy to this dispute that had gone on between the scientists and the CIA on the tubes, calls up Judy Miller and says, what are you doing? You have it exactly backwards. And she says, well, you know, you got to talk to Michael, not me. He talks to Michael. Now, this is what happens in life. Michael Gordon is home waiting for furniture to be moved back to his home, I believe from Russia, and Judy Miller's now in charge of writing the story. She couples it to a piece about Bush's UN speech. Halfway down, she notes that there was a dispute, but she gets it wrong. And she says, once again, that most of the key experts in the government believe the tubes are evidence of a nuclear weapons program. So she compounds the error, and David Albright is even more enraged. The New York Times blew it because he knows that policymakers, other people in the media, people in Congress are reading this stuff and paying close attention.
But the question is here, are we talking about a conscious White House effort to foist a piece of misinformation or just sloppy work and ill-timed furniture delivery on the part of the New York Times?
It's both. It's, you know, I hate to use this old cliche, but it's a perfect storm. You have a White House that is not paying attention to the dispute and is denying internally that it exists. And then when the New York Times latches on to the wrong side of the argument, they're pointing to it and taking advantage of it. After the second Times story comes out, David Albright goes to Joby Warrick, a reporter at the Washington Post, and he gets one of the DOE scientists to talk to him and explain it. And Warrick does write a piece that notes there's been this dispute and that most scientists believe the tubes are not good evidence. And what happens is the Washington Post prints that piece on page A18. And the reason why is that the editors of the Post, you know, look at the piece and they say, oh, Joby Warrick, you're just, you know, upset because you got scooped by the Times on this. So everybody's playing it wrong.
In Monday's speech, marking the fifth anniversary of 9/11, the president continued to link Iraq to the terrible events of that day, but not explicitly. Did those commemorations, in your view, finally transcend politics, as many in the Republican Party and some in the media have claimed, or was he still selling?
Well, of course not. I mean, anytime a politician opens his mouth on either side, there's politics involved. In his speech, once again, going back to the sales campaign, he linked 9/11 to the war in Iraq and said that Saddam Hussein was, quote, a clear threat. Now, everything we've learned since the invasion of Iraq is that it was not a clear threat. The Charles Dofer report, who went and looked for the WMDs on behalf of the administration, said that Saddam Hussein's WMD capability was, quote, essentially destroyed in 1991. And recently, the Senate Intelligence Committee reports noted that there was no working operational relationship between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda. So no connection, no WMDs. What does it mean to say that something was a clear threat? And I wish that reporters would drill down on a phrase like that and say, well, how do you defend this? What does this mean to say it was a clear threat? And that's where the sales campaign sails ahead with rhetoric that often goes unchallenged.
But having lived and breathed the media machine of this White House, David, you've been in Washington a long while. Is it really different from any other White House media machine?
Well, I think they're better in a lot of ways. You know, I.F. Stone, who had the job Washington editor of Nation long before I did, said all governments lie. And I think that's true. And I think reporters have to know that and be more confrontational and more challenging. You can be respectful in doing it. I understand all the anthropological and sociological reasons why it's difficult for reporters to be too confrontational. But I think the lesson of the run-up to the war is that almost you can't be confrontational enough.
David, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
David Korn is the Washington editor of The Nation magazine and author, with Michael Isikoff, of Hubris, the inside story of spin, scandal, and the selling of the Iraq War.
Coming up, the Oxford lad who spent his summer vacation in the middle of an American PSYOPs campaign.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. The work of the Lincoln Group was revealed a little under a year ago in the Los Angeles Times, and it demonstrated the lengths to which the U.S. government was willing to go to get good press in Iraq. Both the initial reporting and the eventual Pentagon investigation detailed the work of the private company, which had been hired by the Pentagon to pay Iraqi media for the placement of stories written by the U.S. military. But there have been few firsthand accounts of the process until this month when Willem Marx revealed what he did over summer vacation in Harper's Magazine. He says that as a student at Oxford, he hungered for the life of a foreign correspondent, and when he saw something called the Lincoln Group advertised for a media intern in Iraq, he jumped at the chance.
I had a place to start the Graduate School of Journalism at NYU the following September, so I jumped at the opportunity to go out to a conflict zone and try my hand at media work in that kind of environment.
Now, once you'd settled in the green zone and you were comfortably there with your fellow Lincolnians, what were your actual tasks?
I was sent stories, I suppose you could call them, by this US military unit based in Camp Victory, and was then sending them on to Iraqis to translate into Arabic and then to place inside Iraqi newspapers. These Iraqi employees of the Lincoln Group would pay newspaper editors to publish these articles.
Based on what material?
Well, I presumed wire stories and their own internal reports from military units around the country.
Did you ever presume that they might be making these stories up out of whole cloth?
I thought there were certainly quotes at times that could easily be fabricated. They seemed to fit too well and, you know, there was very little sourcing behind them. There were certainly times when I thought this could not all be absolutely true.
I remember one story that you particularly liked was in the voice of an Iraqi citizen mourning the death of 23 children who had been killed by an insurgent attack. That was written by a soldier?
Yeah, I think so.
This is obviously a far cry from journalism. Didn't you feel a twinge of conscience now and again?
I did, and again, decided that it was still too big an opportunity to be working out there. I'd be starting graduate school. It wasn't necessarily the best thing possible, and I wasn't necessarily helping anyone. But I tried to improve the way they did things and push stories that maybe weren't being covered by mainstream media but also weren't so one-sided.
Now, the Lincoln Group was employed by the Pentagon, right?
As far as I'm aware, yes.
And yet you were told by your supervisor that you, quote, just had to keep the military happy, and you were warned not to bother them with questions or reveal what it was precisely you were doing. Didn't they know what you were doing?
I think they had a vague idea that we had these incredible links to Iraqi media outlets, which in point of fact really wasn't the case.
In fact, you didn't even know most of the papers you were sending these things to. You were sending them through an intermediary who you call Mohammed in the piece. You didn't know if you were sending them to dailies or weeklies or what audiences they reached. You didn't really know anything, did you?
Absolutely no idea, especially when I got there. I heard of very few of the newspapers, had no idea what their demographic was in terms of readership or anything like that. But there was this attempt by Lincoln Group employees to keep the military in the dark. If they had no idea how we did things, the thinking was that made us a far better strategic partner.
There was also a point where you went to the State Department's Baghdad Press Center, where supposedly Iraqi journalists were being trained in, you know, ethical journalistic practice, and you were trying to hire them for the Lincoln Group. And when people at the Baghdad Press Center asked you about your work, you said that you were running ad campaigns for multinationals. And you wrote, which was effectively true, excuse me, that's not true at all.
No, you're right. Absolutely right.
And you lied.
I'm not sure I lie there. I think it's one of the biggest paradoxes of my time out there was that you have the Pentagon on one side willing to influence and abrogate the responsibilities of local journalists. And at the same time, you have the State Department pumping millions of dollars into training these Iraqi journalists, trying to encourage a new, independent, democratic, journalistic way of operating. I, at the time, was pretty worried about giving the game away. I didn't know how secret we were meant to be. There was certainly this shroud of secrecy encouraged by my seniors, and was quite willing to tell little white lies to the State Department woman I'd meet at the press center.
But you were successful at what you did. You managed to place a lot of articles into a lot of Iraqi newspapers.
I think, yeah, money talks in Iraq. And these newspaper editors, for right or wrong, were willing to take thousands of dollars to support their families, help their friends. I think anyone, whether they were my age, 40, far more experienced, far less experienced, could have done it as long as they had the right Iraqi contacts.
But at some point, that project went a little off the rails because you got involved with a much bigger project, a $16 million project that the Lincoln Group had taken on and wasn't really capable of pulling off, I guess.
It was actually nearer to $20 million, and it was over 2 months for placing TV commercials, radio commercials, TV and radio news spots as well as ramping up the amount of pieces printed in newspapers. And I was so busy on a day-to-day basis trying to set that up so that it could start working, that I kind of lost sight of the other newspaper contract I'd been involved in initially.
And what happened?
Well, it seemed that Iraqi employees of the company started skimming off large amounts of cash from the sums we were paying to newspaper editors to run these pieces. Well, you know, maybe $1,000 a time. I couldn't be sure. I had no idea how they paid the editors. I had no idea whether it was cash, how the money changed hands. I found myself as a 23-year-old carrying a gun, talking to these men, accusing them of stealing money, threatening them. And I'd already decided what I was doing was hardly an ethical career to follow. But that was the moment when I thought, you know, there's no point me staying out here for another day longer.
The article is written in rather a naive voice. It strikes me that this voyage of discovery that you take us on in Harper's was perhaps discovered a bit before you actually got very far into it.
I'm not a naive person. I knew there were risks going out there, but the extent to which I'd be involved in this kind of operation was really not clear to me at the time.
Willem, thank you very much.
Good to talk to you, Brett.
Willem Marx's essay, Misinformation Intern, My Summer as a Military Propagandist in Iraq, is in the September issue of Harper's. He's currently a journalism graduate student at New York University.
When details of the Lincoln Group's work first emerged, it prompted declarations by the White House and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff that the possibility of buying good press was a serious cause for concern. 4 months later, a Pentagon investigation found that while the Lincoln Group had paid to plant stories, it had not committed any legal or military violations. Last month, the military again called for bids for a 2-year, $20 million contract for help in its message management. The chosen company will, among other things, grade the media on how favorably they cover the U.S. in Iraq and help strategize on ways to improve that coverage. Lieutenant Colonel Barry Johnson is the director of the Combined Press Information Center for the multinational forces in Iraq. He says that despite the concerns about the Lincoln Group, propaganda is not what his shop is aiming for.
Not in any way a part of a contract being considered. What had occurred before was part of an investigation that was done by a unit subordinate to the force here. I engage with the Iraqi media every day. And we do it in the same way we do the Western media. We do press conferences. We talk to them when they have queries. We call them on the phone when we see mistakes, and we invite them in to talk to our people.
What do you think the central problem of media coverage is, and what do you think the military can do about it?
Well, simply that we cannot compete against an enemy who has the tools to go out and indiscriminately kill people, which is going to make the news. I think part of the frustration right now, too, is trying to bring in a media that has been covering this for a long time, and the conditions for them have gotten extremely difficult. And they're constrained in their reporting. They're constrained in their resources to be able to get with our troops on the ground. So we're seeking ways to ensure that they are able to get with our troops as much as possible because we know they're our greatest storytellers. But it's difficult.
Bidding has just concluded on a 2-year, $20 million contract for outside PR help that would assist the coalition in meeting its message goals. Can you tell me what this contract will entail and who's been hired?
Closing for the bid has passed and the evaluation is ongoing. But the purpose of this is not abnormal by any means. It's something that's done throughout government agencies, and a lot of it is very basic stuff. It's a monitoring of media and determining what's being said out there and providing advice when necessary. It may be as simple as getting qualified people in to design website for us and help manage it, a skill that we don't have in the military.
So let's say this outside PR firm comes in and monitors the media and says this media organization is clobbering us and this one's been a little more receptive of our message. This one is completely off the reservation. Then what?
Well, you know, that's not really what they're doing. And actually, that's a lot of what I do in building the relationships with the media here. And these people who are hired on this contract certainly provide me some insights as to what's going on out there. But ultimately, it's down to me and people like me who are building the relationship and going out and talking to them about it.
I want to refer to a remark made by Defense Secretary Rumsfeld recently, I believe, to the American Legion. He observed that a Congressional Medal of Honor recipient got one-tenth the coverage of a soldier punished for misconduct in Iraq. Does the Pentagon not grasp the central fact that good news is, by definition, not much in the way of news, that no one reads the paper to learn about the train that didn't derail?
Well, that's always a frustration, isn't it? We see people out here doing great things every day, and we want it to be a part of the news, and we want them to get recognition. And part of the great frustration among military leaders to see those things go unnoticed when the bombing of the day does make the news.
Is it a frustration in dealing with your superiors that their expectations for what constitutes fair-minded coverage doesn't jibe with how real journalism is conducted?
It's certainly a part of what I do. It's an ongoing educational process where I try to explain why what's in the news is and what makes a story and where the conflict exists in any given story. I will tell you that a large part of our problem is simply not being able to respond in as timely a manner, because we want to get the facts. We want to make sure all the commanders know what's going up the chain and that it's been verified. There are people out there making tough decisions every day, life and death decisions. And because of that, they often think that they shouldn't be talking, that they're afraid to put out too much information. And so our story doesn't get told.
All right. Well, Colonel Johnson, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Lieutenant Colonel Barry Johnson is the director of the Combined Press Information Center for the multinational forces in Iraq. He spoke to us from Baghdad. The chairman of the Federal Communications Commission was on Capitol Hill this week at a hearing to reconfirm him as FCC chairman. Republican Kevin Martin has been criticized for being too political to be a fair-minded regulator, but the hearing at the Senate Commerce Committee was polite, and there seems little doubt that Martin will be reconfirmed. Still, lawmakers took the chance to express their displeasure with current FCC policies. Jessica Smith was there to cover that hearing for us. Jessica, there was a bit of a showdown over media concentration at the hearings, but before we get to that, just please review how we got to where we are. It started, I gather, with Martin's predecessor, Michael Powell.
That's right, Bob. Powell and Martin reportedly did not get along, but that was a personality thing. Ideologically, when it came to relaxing media ownership rules, they were pretty much on the same page. It just wasn't the same page as Congress. So when the FCC voted in 2003 to adopt rule changes that would have allowed companies much greater ownership of various media outlets in a single market, there was an outpouring of anger from Congress. The Senate voted to disapprove the rules, and public groups took the FCC to court, which ultimately overturned the FCC's rules, or rather sent them back and told the commissioners to make a better case.
So that predated Kevin Martin's chairmanship. In terms of cross-ownership and the rest, what has happened on his watch?
Nothing. It's pretty much been status quo.
Okay, so this gets us to Tuesday's hearing. The issue continues to ruffle feathers, it seems.
Yeah, and it's senators on both sides of the aisle who are concerned. Some say media concentration is antithetical to free flow of information. This is a Democrat from North Dakota, Senator Byron Dorgan.
Would you agree with me that we have seen very substantial concentration in almost every area of the media in recent years?
In the recent years, we have seen this more concentration. Since the 1996 Act passed, in which the commission changed some of those rules, there's been significant increases since.
Do you believe that increased concentration in most cases will likely be moving against the issue of localism, and that localism with respect to broadcasting and the use of the airwaves that belong to all of the American people, localism is essential and center to the notion of what broadcasting is about?
Localism, Jessica?
Localism means local content. There's a fear that too much network ownership is eroding local news content. For example, a station in the Midwest has long offered regular hog price reports, but then a big chain takes it over and cuts out the hog reports. Or maybe a big network buys a local station and cuts down on local news reporting because it's cheaper to use nationally syndicated pieces. Now, the FCC was looking into this. They were doing a study on localism. And at the hearing this week, Senator Barbara Boxer, a Democrat from California, asked Martin whatever happened to that study. Here's Martin's response.
That was never completed by Chairman Powell. When I took over as chairman, it was already supposed to have been completed. I think the commission had originally promised to do that by the end of...
You kind of want to wince. You can see Martin leaning into Boxer's left hook.
Yeah. Suddenly, Boxer held up a copy of that very FCC report in her hand, and she asked Martin if he'd ever seen it. He said no.
Well, I'm going to ask you to please go back after you look at it again. I'm going to ask all the other commissioners to tell me if they ever saw this report, because according to it, local ownership, this is a quote, adds almost 5.5 minutes of local news and over 3 minutes of local on-location news. That's over 5 minutes for each 30-minute local news broadcast. In the course of a year, this means locally owned stations provide over 33 more hours of regional news, news that's directly relevant and important to viewers. Now, this isn't national security, for God's sakes. I mean, this is important information. So I don't understand who deep sixed this thing. I want to get to the bottom of it and find out if any commissioners saw this.
She's implying that the FCC did a study, found out that media concentration deprives Americans of satisfactory broadcast news and public affairs coverage of their communities, and then buried the findings for political reasons.
Well, that's what it looks like. And 2 days after the hearing, I saw some news that said FCC managers ordered staff to destroy all copies of this report. Now, one FCC critic I spoke to says this could be really embarrassing to Martin, and this could undermine Martin's continued effort to relax the rules. The timing is also pretty important because this report has emerged just as the FCC is launching a series of hearings around the country to find out what the public has to say on the issue.
Okay, score a political point for the Democrats. But at one point in the hearing, Martin himself seemed to distance himself from the big media love affair of his predecessor.
I would call it a fumbling effort to save face or avoid confrontation when Dorgan asked him if he was concerned or if it gives him pause that the commission's 2003 ruling would allow one company to own 8 radio stations, 3 TV stations, the daily newspaper, and the cable company in one market. Here's Martin's response.
Yes, it gives me pause, and I'm not so sure I would even concede that I was comfortable with the decision when we made the decision previously.
Didn't he vote for the 2003 rule change?
Yes, he did.
All right, Jessica. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks, Bob.
Jessica Smith covered this week's FCC confirmation hearing on Capitol Hill. A few days after the hearing, Chairman Martin sent a letter to Senator Boxer regarding the pesky issue of that buried report. He repeated that no one on his staff had seen the report, nor were they aware of it, but conceded, quote, "It appears to cover issues relevant to both our open localism proceeding and our recently commenced media ownership proceeding." Martin emphasized that the report had been entered into the record and would be made publicly available to the media.
Coming up, blogs punch holes in the congressional pork barrel, and Lonely Girl is lonely no more.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kresge Foundation, investing in nonprofits to help them catalyze growth, connect to stakeholders, and challenge greater support. On the web at kresge.org. The Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities. On the web at wallacefoundation.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Remember all those years ago when cable took off, along with CNN and HBO? Suddenly we saw channels we never thought could make it, devoted solely to food or the weather or...
These are our graduated crescent dangle earrings, all done in 14-karat yellow gold. They're QVC priced at $86.50. They are brand new.
Cable TV opened the doors to all those channels by opening bandwidth. But now, with HDTV, the internet, and even phone service all jammed into that same cable wire, bandwidth is a limited commodity again. Soon, though, it may not matter because video on demand, or VOD, doesn't use the same bandwidth as regular cable. Instead, video is stored on a computer server. All you have to do is use your remote control to navigate through a few menus and pick out what you want. Nowadays, people usually use it to pick up special events, movies, or shows that they missed on HBO. But wait, VOD may soon be the door through which all new channels must pass. Alex Goldmark has more.
What is this?
You can barely even defeat a pathetic little zoonoid.
Oh, no, not another one.
Have to do with this?
Rabbi Joseph Potasnik hosts Faith to Faith.
The rabbis want what those zoonoids have, a cable channel. And they plan to follow the path of the anime network's zoonoids in getting one.
You're watching Shalom TV, celebrating Jewish culture.
It took him over 2 years of planning, schmoozing, and compromising before Rabbi Mark Golub could launch what he calls the nation's first Jewish-focused TV channel earlier this month.
There's no place on American television where if you're a young family and you have children, you can set a child down in front of a television to see lovely Jewish programming for children.
Now for the kids, there's Mr. Bookstein's Store. And for the grown-ups, a dating show, movies, news, the whole gamut of a typical cable channel, just Jewish-themed. And like any niche channel, Rabbi Golub thinks his programming will fill a void and build a loyal audience of, say, 200,000 homes. Now that's small for a national cable channel, but big enough to make a profit. The problem is convincing the cable companies.
In a typical Catch-22, you can't get ratings about how great your channel is until you're carried a bunch of places.
Industry analyst Josh Burnoff of Forrester Research.
So they basically have to come in and say, look, you know, we've determined that 18% of consumers in your area are interested in horses. So the horse channel really ought to be on the air in your area. And that's not a theoretical example. There is a channel called the Horse Channel.
Beloved farm animals aside, he says almost nobody is launching new channels right now.
There's a pretty strong desire not to use up channel space for anything that's not essential.
But if channel space is irrelevant, there's plenty of room for experimenting with new channels. Enter Video on Demand, or VOD.
Last year, our Comcast customers alone watched 700 million hours of television in a way that didn't even exist 3 years ago.
Paige Thompson is vice president of video services at Comcast, and he is thrilled about the new way to watch TV. True, there isn't even a proven ad model yet, and at this point, there isn't much original content available.
But with on-demand, somebody who has a great idea or who can reach a small niche audience now suddenly has a distribution vehicle.
So far, the loudest launch on that new vehicle is the WWE Pro Wrestling Channel. Now, pro wrestling's been on TV for decades, and sometimes pay-per-view might seem like the wrestling channel. But this is the first time they've had their own network, for now on VOD. WWE's Executive Vice President, Tom Barreca.
We are much more mass market, I think, than you'll see a lot of the sort of sliver services that are out there. We're broad and we're deep. Everybody you meet, even the NPR listeners, has a wrestling story.
And he's banking on that nostalgia to bring in the business. For $7.99 a month, you'll see an ever-changing 20 hours of past fights. Like the classic for any fan old enough to rent a car without parental permission.
Oh, slam! Andre picked him up with ease!
Ah, yes. Hulk Hogan versus Andre the Giant.
Right in that lower lumbar region, that kidney area, that's already been damaged.
If Hulk and his cohorts can prove they can consistently draw an audience, then maybe, just maybe, Comcast will cede them the bandwidth they crave.
This is sort of like the minor leagues of television channels.
Again, analyst Josh Burnoff.
So you get yourself in video on demand, and then you just see if you can get people to have a look at it. And if you can become successful as a video on demand channel, then you can try and take your place among the broadcast channels, the hundreds of broadcast channels that are already out there.
That's exactly what the Anime Network did with its video archive of Zoonoids and other Japanese favorites. And that's what Shalom TV, the Jewish channel, is trying to do. Only it wants to be the first to produce a whole new lineup for video on demand, not just reused archives.
They said to us, Shalom TV, Jewish programming, we don't have space for you.
Rabbi Mark Golub.
But you know, the idea you're pitching us sounds so interesting. We will put you up on our server and let's see.
Now they're testing the subscription model at $7.99 a month for 50 regularly updated hours of TV.
We're entering a world where anyone who can pull together an audience of 100,000 people will be able to get on television.
Josh Burnoff of Forrester Research.
It's just that instead of being famous for 15 minutes, they'll have their 15 megabytes of space on the cable company's server, and then they have to go out and actually reach that audience.
Right now, video on demand might be that place you get movies from when you're too lazy to go to Blockbuster or while you're waiting for your next Netflix. But pretty soon, when you hear VOD, you might think of it as where all your new favorite channels got their start. For On the Media, I'm Alex Goldmark in New York.
It wasn't the comprehensive ethics reform they'd been pushing for on Capitol Hill, but good government groups did have something to celebrate this week. The House approved two measures to combat so-called earmarks. The pet projects slipped into spending legislation. In other words, pork straight from the barrel. One rule change requires House members to put their names on the earmarks they propose. The other is a bill, already approved in the Senate, that would create a public, searchable web database of all federal grants and contracts. That bill was introduced in the spring, but then was secretly put on hold by a couple of senators, preventing it from a full vote.
Enter the citizen watchdogs. In a rare show of unity, a coalition of liberal and conservative blogs asked readers to call their senators and find out if they had imposed the hold. Volunteers managed to narrow it down to four possible culprits, at which point Republican Ted Stevens stepped forward and claimed responsibility. The next day, Democrat Robert Byrd admitted he'd also placed a hold. The bill was quickly passed. Zephyr Teachout is the national director for the Sunlight Foundation, one of the groups who participated in the effort. She says it was instructive not just to the blogging faithful, but also to the senators themselves.
This hadn't really been an issue that I think senators realized so many people cared about. You know, when I called my senators' offices and other people had the same experiences, one of the things we all noticed is that the senators' offices weren't necessarily ready to take calls like this, calls from constituents asking for a position on a particular piece of legislation, let alone asking for a position on a procedural aspect of a bill. And I think it's the beginning of a shift. I think that these kinds of campaigns will change the way that senators' offices are set up, and I think that's a wonderful thing.
This project was a great triumph, but there's other stuff going on. Tapping, you know, the power of the collective blogosphere. The Sunlight Foundation launched a new project this week called the Punch Clock Campaign. Tell me what you're doing with it.
With the Punch Clock Campaign, we are offering $1,000 to any person who persuades a member of Congress to put their daily schedule on the internet. We're also offering $250 to any person who persuades a federal candidate, FEC-qualified federal candidate, to commit to putting their daily schedule on the internet.
Okay, well, putting the money aside for a moment, what's the benefit of knowing legislators' daily schedules?
Well, most of us have to submit timesheets or at least tell our bosses what we're doing every day. Now with the internet, Congress members have the same opportunity to report back to us. This year, this Congress is supposed to spend less time in legislative session than any Congress since the infamous do-nothing Congress since 1948. But that doesn't mean they're on vacation the whole time. It means that they are taking our publicly paid for time and doing other things with it. Perhaps it's preparing legislation. Perhaps it's preparing legislation with lobbyists. The difference between those two is pretty vast, as we all know.
Eventually, I guess the theory is Congress people who would prefer not to reveal their schedules will be shamed into delivering
yes.
that information.
And they should be. There is such a deep, entrenched culture of closedness in Congress, of arcane rules that allow you to be a little bit dismissive of that public that just doesn't understand. Congress members on their own, for the most part, are not going to voluntarily switch to a new culture. The only way they're going to do it is if thousands of people demand it of them.
Okay, got that. But what's with the bounty?
anyone who can persuade their member of Congress to put their schedule on the internet is providing an extraordinarily important public service, and we want to pay them for valuable work done.
There's another initiative called Congresspedia. Tell me how that works.
Congresspedia is using the Wiki software to pull together information about each Congress member. It would seem pretty straightforward, but it's pretty hard to find detailed information about individual members of Congress in a single place. So again, it's another form of finding a way to do two things at once. One is strengthen the relationship between people and their representatives by giving them basic facts about who their representative is and creating opportunities for those people who want to get involved in political life in more ways than voting.
It's easy to look at these various initiatives as ways to change the behavior of our elected officials. But there's a flip side of it, which I think is probably equally encouraging, and that is to change the behavior of citizens. In this "what does one vote do" culture, the idea of actually holding representatives accountable seems to suggest opportunities for actually an engaged electorate.
Yeah, you really hit the nail on the head. Our representatives are not going to be any better or worse than we are. The past several decades, there's been a really narrow definition of what it is to be a citizen. We talk about citizenship as voting, jury duty, maybe if you're really active, writing a letter to the editor. But that's actually an anomaly in American history. In the 1920s, 5% of Americans were presidents, not just members, presidents of their local voluntary association, like the Knights of Pythias or the Grange. In the TV era, so much of that was lost, and now we have new mediating institutions that aren't like the Knights of Pythias. They're not locally based in the same way, but these new capacities for people to actively engage as citizens. If we don't have a culture of citizenship, we don't have a democracy. It's really that fundamental.
Okay, Zephyr. Well, thank you so much.
Sure. Thank you.
Zephyr Teachout is National Director for the Sunlight Foundation, a new openness in government group in Washington, D.C.
Look at Bree, she's not lonely. And 15, she might not be. People are pissed at a fake Satanist. Oh, why? How could you, Bree?
For those of you who missed it, this summer's internet obsession was a putative 15-year-old named Bree, a.k.a. Lonely Girl 15, who posted a video diary of her narrow but deeply felt life on YouTube, that global repository of mostly homemade videos. Lonely Girl was sweet, a science geek, a possible Satanist, there were hints, and a great big mystery. Some 500,000 avid fans tuned into her video musings, filmed mostly in her bedroom by her pal and potential love interest, Daniel. And viewers weighed in with comments and video responses to her and the community that had formed around her on YouTube.
A lot of you guys were commenting on the hiking video. I mean, I was laughing at the fact that everybody was saying that he liked me, and I just asked him, I said, "Well, do you?" And he didn't say anything for a really long time, and then he just said that he did.
But soon something happened. The speculation moved from her relationship with Daniel, her repressive parents, and her unspecified religion to the very authenticity of Bree herself. And then this week, suddenly it was all over. Bree was exposed as a 19-year-old acting student by the name of Jessica Rose, and Lonely Girl as the brainchild of some aspiring filmmakers test-driving, they say, a new form of participatory art. Oh, Lonely Girl, we hardly knew ye. And it seems some of us preferred it that way. Braves Girl 5 venting on YouTube.
You know, it just sucks because there's so many people who made video responses to Lonely Girl's videos, and you know what? They're gonna feel stupid now because they got caught up in the drama, and since everything about Bree was bullshit, I don't think she's gonna be half as popular as she was before because the fans of Lonely Girl, they're gonna know, okay, well, this is fake, so it doesn't really matter.
Jane McGonigal, a game designer and expert in the field of collaborative play, says that if the public turns against the creators of Lonely Girl, they have only themselves to blame, because her creators never gave the public a chance to actively participate in the game that was Lonely Girl. Viewers didn't know the rules. In fact, they didn't even know for sure it was a game.
You can have a lot more fun if it's just a story, right? If you're not concerned about ruining someone's life, if you're only ruining a character's life, you can be a lot more creative. You can push harder on it. It makes a big difference for audiences to have a kind of transparency where they can see through the frame and understand how far they can take it.
But all viewers could do was post on YouTube. And ultimately, it was more fun talking to each other about Bree than talking to Bree.
The audience decided the primary puzzle was not what will happen next in the story. The real puzzle was, who is this woman? And I think a lot of that meta gaming happened because there weren't more things to do in the formal environment of the Lonely Girl world. If there had been more ways to game her life, we might have seen that community's energy be driven towards the experience itself rather than going outside the boundaries of the experience to rip the mask off the puppet masters.
And rip they did, thanks largely to Matt Faremski, 18-year-old son of Tom Faremski, a former Financial Times reporter turned blogger at SiliconValleyWatch.com. Matt linked from Bree's YouTube page to her MySpace page, which was locked up, but then took her MySpace username and plugged it into Google, where he searched its cache pages, where he found some photos and, oh, never mind. The point is, he found Jessica Rose, and he's glad. But he still doesn't know what to think about Lonely Girl.
I'd like to see what their intent was with the whole campaign, if they're just doing a true experiment for experiment's sake, or they were trying to make a viral marketing campaign and they'll try to monetize it in some way. I'm not a fan of that, and I'm sure their user base would be spurned by that, too.
But if they weren't doing it to make money, you'd be more accepting.
Yeah, of course, because it's more authentic.
More authentically fake?
Yes.
Thank you, Bree, for showing me not to believe all I see. Right from your dorm, you made a new art form. But now, goodbye to Bree.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Fuolo, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director, and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer, and John Keefe, our executive producer. We took that musical clip about Bree from Highly Defective People from YouTube. Bassist-composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Is she real? Is this a big corporation scam?
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Oh, really? You don't think we figured that out, did you?
On the Media is supported by Ciaobella Gelato, purveyors of all natural gelato and sorbet. Ciaobella is available nationwide at specialty food markets. More information at ciaobellagelato.com or 1-800-GELATO-3. Support for On the Media also comes from the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Thanks for checking out this week's On the Media from WNYC, New York Public Radio. Support your local public radio station. Visit onthemedia.org to find where On the Media is playing near you. And please help support this free service by becoming a member of WNYC at WNYC.org. And thanks.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.